Well, this is the Berean class. I don't got any guests. Welcome. Jim Abrahamson is our teacher, and for the last couple of 3 weeks, he's been talking to us about ethics, Christian ethics, and he's talked to us about the acquisition of the principles that we have from the Bible. It's affirmation. He kind of summarized that last week. And today we're going to talk about an application, and then I'm not sure what he's going to do when he comes back. But we're going to talk about euthanasia. It's kind of an interesting subject. It's a subject that pertains to all of us because we all face death at some point in time in our life. Right now there are 6 states in the United States that allow euthanasia. There's about 5 or 6 countries that allow it, and so it seems to be gaining momentum, and I thought it would be an important subject to talk about today, especially from a doctor's position. I've dealt with patients where this question has come up, and it's not an easy topic. One reason it's not easy is that it has a lot of different parts to it. We talk about DNR, do not resuscitate. Or we talk about CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. What do you do when a patient is not getting better and is on a respirator? Is it right to pull the tube and take them off the respirator? What about feeding tubes? There's been a big controversy about that. Living wills, health care, power of attorney. Just all sorts of issues come up as we talk about this. I want to start out by giving you a case history and see what your response would be, and then we might come back to that if we have time. I got a call a couple of months ago from a person that I've known for a long, long time. She and her husband have a child who at the age of about 3 or 4 months was found to have infantile seizures. And this syndrome causes severe mental retardation. This child was never developed beyond about a 6-month-old. She's now 45. They took care of her for probably 40 years. And then when they got to be 65, they made her a ward of the state. She's now in a home with several other people like that. She's been 100% care. They had to feed her. They had to dress her. They had to change her diapers. Again, she never developed beyond about a 6-month-old, and she's now 45. The doctor at the care facility that she's at called not long ago and said she's stopped eating. When I talked to the mother, she said she felt like it was because of the medication she was getting. She's on a lot of seizure medications. They apparently don't taste very good. And so they mix it with the food, and apparently the child, or if you want to still call her that, perceives that as the bad taste and just has stopped eating altogether. So the question is, do we put in a feeding tube? What would you do? What would your advice be to this mother?
No
feeding tube.
Yeah.
No feeding tube.
Yeah.
All right.
I was concerned with that. I mean, she's 45. If you look at it from an adult independent standpoint, even if she is physiologically, mentally like a 6-month-old, chronologically she's 45. So you could take the logical position that she's an adult. And if she has the ability to refuse to eat, then she's making an independent choice.
All right. But in the perception of the mother, she's not eating because of the medication.
And
so her reply to that would be, well, we're going to give her medication through the feeding tube that will restore her taste, and so then the only thing that she seems to enjoy is eating, and she'll hopefully start eating again.
Tara, what would we do if she was not in this condition? Would our answer be different if she had not been in the a 6-month-old and a 45-year-old father?
You mean,
what if she was a normal 45-year-old person? Would our answer be different?
Good question. Any other comments? I'm not going to give you the answer. All right. Well, that's part of the problem.
Charles, we got a comment.
Oh, yeah. There's another comment.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
I'm a nurse. I've seen a lot of similar things. And as a mom, I'm not answering as a mom, but I'm answering as a nurse, that I think the right thing to do would just let nature take its course. Either take her off the meds.
Okay.
And allow that to happen so at least she can enjoy eating, or let her not eat. But
okay.
No, I would not do the eating.
Okay.
Also, once you go on a feeding tube, then what do you do? I mean, can you? It would be very hard at that point to take somebody off of a feeding tube, I would think.
Okay. All right. We'll come back to that. Okay. Euthanasia. What does it mean? Euthanasia. What does the word mean? When you hear the word euthanasia, what do you think of?
Mercy killing.
Means beautiful death.
Means what?
Beautiful death.
Beautiful death. It comes from Greek. It means a good death. It's two Greek words, good and death. We all recall in antiquity, Socrates took hemlock and died a peaceful death. This was a suicide, but it was a peaceful death. And up until Christianity came, euthanasia was accepted in antiquity. But then, of course, when Christianity came in, because we're made in the image of God, it was felt that this was a wrong thing to do, and euthanasia sort of fell out of favor. Then in the late 1700s, 1800s, with the Enlightenment, then we began to talk about euthanasia again. And so now we're dealing with euthanasia, which basically has a different definition than what it had then. The definition of euthanasia today is the intentional act and practice of killing another person for his or her alleged benefit. And I underline those two words because that's kind of the crux of the problem. Intentional means that you intervene in the disease process to enhance death. You interrupt that process to add something that hadn't to do anything with the disease that the person has to help them die.
Sure.
And it's... Yes?
Where'd you get the definition?
This is a common definition. If you look it up, Google it, almost every site gives that. You've got another definition. Okay, it does put a bias on it. And I'm presenting this from my viewpoint as a doctor.
Charles.
Okay, yes.
Richard Brewster, I'm Bill Stevenson's father-in-law. I suspect that this has been going on for centuries, many years, and nobody's made a big deal about it because doctors and maybe family members have made these decisions and it's just happened and no one's made a big deal about it.
I think you're probably right, and we'll get into some of that. Another way to express this, if you really want to think about it this way, and this is the proper way to do it, is it's assisted suicide. Suicide is where someone takes their own life. But euthanasia, in today's definition, is they want to commit suicide, but they need help. And so they ask for a family member or, in the case that you point out, a doctor to help them die.
Quick question. Sorry.
Yes.
Would that, the first definition there, would that include, say, trying to keep someone out of pain, giving them a lot of morphine to keep them pain-free?
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
You're a thought ahead of me.
Okay.
You're a thought ahead of my slides. All right. So now let's get into some of the definitions to kind of see if we can clear up some of this confusion. One definition that is important is, what do we mean when we say the patient is terminal? And generally, in the medical field, most people consider terminal the fact that you're probably going to die of your disease within the next 6 months. This is the qualification to qualify for hospice care. A hospice won't take a patient under their care if it's anticipated they'll last longer than that. Now, you know, it's guesswork. I've had patients that I thought were going to die in the next few weeks, and they've lived for a year. And I've had patients that I thought, you know, this is a slow-growing cancer, and they'll probably live several years, but then they die in a month or two. So, you know, when you talk to a doctor, most doctors are not going to give you precise information. They're going to say, well, you have probably a few months to a couple of years to live, you know, or something such as that. So it's not precise, and we do the best we can under the circumstances, and we miss it. But it's generally considered terminal is death within the next 6 months. When we talk about suicide, I've already mentioned that. That's self-administered. Now that we're talking about euthanasia, that's help. Euthanasia can be broken down into voluntary euthanasia. This is the patient that comes into the hospital. Their mind is clear. They're still awake. And they ask the doctor or the family to help them die. They don't want to suffer pain anymore. They want to have control over their destiny, and so they need some help. And in fact, all of the euthanasia laws that are written in the United States today use a doctor as the assistant. If a family member does it, it's not legal, technically. It has to be a doctor. That's voluntary euthanasia. Involuntary euthanasia is somebody that maybe expressed it to their family that, you know, if I'm ever in a vegetative state, I don't want to live any longer. But now that they're in a vegetative state, they're unable to express that to the doctor or anyone else. So that's involuntary. They have no control over it at that point in time, but they express a desire maybe at an earlier time. And then non-voluntary euthanasia is the example that I gave of the child mentally retarded from the age of 6 months, never had the mental ability to make a decision one way or the other. And that's non-voluntary euthanasia. Some confusing terms, active and passive. Active euthanasia and passive euthanasia are terms that are not really endorsed by Christian doctors. If you look at the CMDA site, Christian Medical Dental Association site, they don't like it at all. But the issue really is that it's something that the lay public understands. And so it's a term that we have to know. And I don't think there's anything wrong with using it. Active euthanasia is usually thought of as an act of commission. It's something you intentionally do to intervene with the disease process to help the patient commit suicide. Passive euthanasia is what you talked about, allowing the patient to die naturally of their disease. There's no hope, they're terminal, and just allow the disease to take its course. So that's what we're the difference between active euthanasia and passive euthanasia. It's interesting. The term euthanasia is not really used in the German-speaking countries because of the World War II experience under the Nazis. And they use assisted suicide is the term that they use mostly over there. So euthanasia is used here in America and in the Western culture. right to die is another term that you see, and this really is supported by both sides. It's a constitutional right. It was decided in, when was it, 76 by the Supreme Court in the Quinlan case. They said that everyone has the constitutional right to decide the timing and the manner in which they die. It's a constitutional right. So the right to die is really supported by both sides. Someone used a comment about mercy killing. Mercy killing was a term that really was pushed by Jack Kevorkian. Most of you remember him back in the 70s and the 80s. He devised this machine. He would mix up a concoction of narcotics so that it would inject the patient with an overdose of narcotics. The patient would push the button to allow the machine to be activated. He was tried four times. Each time it ended in an acquittal or a hung jury, and so he was never convicted of it. But then he made a mistake. He videotaped it. It got on TV. I don't know whether I saw it on TV back in the late 70s, I guess. And in that particular time, he pushed the button. And then he taunted the authorities to arrest him. And they did. And they tried him. And they convicted him of murder. And he went to jail for 7 or 8 years. Then was released with the promise not to do it anymore, talk about it. Died a couple of years later. But that was Jack Kevorkian. He was a doctor, but he was called the doctor of death. He was a pathologist. He had never really taken care of a live patient. So it makes you wonder if he wasn't just infatuated with death. But anyhow, he said that he had assisted 130 people in committing suicide. That was Jack Kevorkian. And mercy killing is sort of what he's known for. He called it mercy killing because he said this was an act of compassion. A physician-assisted suicide is basically what we're talking about today. And that's when the physician helps the person commit suicide, usually by giving them a prescription of narcotics, and the person takes an overdose. So the physician assists in prescribing the medicine, but the patient takes it. And then there's euphemisms that we use. Euthanasia kind of might carry a bad connotation in some people's minds, so they talk about physician-assisted dying. That seems to be a little bit better way to express it in some people's minds, or compassionate dying, etc., etc. All right, let's talk a little bit about the history. I've already talked about antiquity and so forth. First major law that was passed that had any impact on what we understand today as euthanasia was a law passed in Germany in 1933 about congenitally ill progeny. And the concept there was that if there was a person that was severely mentally retarded, they had bad genes, and you didn't want them having children, to pass along these bad genes, and therefore they sterilize these people. It's been big news here in North Carolina recently from the eugenics program back in the 60s and the 70s. They had the same program in Mississippi where I came from, and I suspect in several other states. So this was something that was a pretty widely, I wouldn't say accepted, but it was pretty widely being discussed, and even laws are being passed to support this kind of thing. Euthanasia was kind of a hot topic back in the 20s and the 30s until the drinker tank came out. Anybody know what the drinker tank is? It's what we know as the iron lung. Back then we had a lot of polio. And these people, some of them will get paralysis of their respiratory muscles from the nervous involvement. Some of these would recover, but some didn't. And the iron lung was designed to help them so that hopefully they would recover. But the problem was that some didn't recover, and they were stuck in an iron lung for the rest of their life. And so then that kind of inflamed the discussion of euthanasia. Is that the right thing to do? But then World War II came along. The slippery slope entered into the picture, where now you not only sterilize people, but voluntary euthanasia, then involuntary euthanasia, then non-voluntary euthanasia, and then ethnic cleansing in the Nazi concentration camps. So then it was never discussed for another 20 or 30 years until the 1970s. And in the 1970s, the big case was a Karen Quinlan case. This was a young woman that took an overdose of narcotics for a high and overdid it and ended up in a vegetative state. And she was on a respirator. And the family wanted to remove her from the respirator, saying that she had expressed the desire not to live if she was ever in a condition like that. Well, it got into the legal system. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that was one of the major cases that came up with we all have a constitutional right to determine the time and manner in which we die. And so therefore she was removed from the respirator. Interestingly enough, she didn't die. She lasted for another 4 or 5 years at home and finally succumbed at home. But that was kind of the first case that really broke the ice on the discussion of euthanasia. The next case was a Nancy Kuzin case. Any of y'all remember that? This was a young woman in Missouri that was involved in an automobile accident, rendered into a vegetative state, placed on a feeding tube. And this went through the court system. And the courts would not recognize either the right or wrongness of this, saying that that this was not to pull the tube, that a tube was meant for nutrition. It was to sustain life. It was not treatment of a disease. And so they refused to make a verdict on it. The lower court eventually allowed the family to remove the tube. And she died about 3 weeks later from starvation. But these two cases, the Quinlan case and the Kruzen case, were the big legal cases that were in the papers all the time for a number of years, and really brought the discussion of euthanasia to the forefront. The first law attempted to be passed was a resolution in the state of Washington in 1996. It failed 51% to 49%. If you've read the papers lately, within the last couple of years, the state of Washington has revisited that issue, and now it's passed, and Washington is a state where euthanasia, that is, physician-assisted suicide, is legal. The first state where that occurred was in Oregon. It likewise was passed around 1997, but it didn't become law until 2002 because of all the legal battles over it. And basically, the government said this is a state division, not a decision to be made by the federal government. So each state has the right to pass laws either supporting euthanasia. You cannot pass a law outlawing euthanasia. That was settled in the courts because they said that this infringed upon our constitutional rights of determining time and manner of death. When Oregon passed their law, they put a lot of what they felt were good safeguards to protect the patient against abuse of euthanasia. For example, the person had to make a written request. And by that time, living wills, health care, power of attorney had become into vogue. And that was, of course, a major impetus behind those two cases. So you had to make a written request. The patient had to be terminal, that is, expected to die within 6 months. There had to be a consult of another physician to confirm the diagnosis. If the person was depressed, they had to get a psychiatric evaluation because depression can be treated medically very successfully. There was a 48-hour waiting period between the request and the taking of the overdose to allow the person to think about it carefully before they were allowed to do it. And there were a couple of other things, but those were the major things. And most of the laws, if you look at the states as well as countries, include these kind of protective mechanisms with some variation between them, but most of them have to do that. And all of the laws, as I stated before, it allows the physician to be the assistant, no one else, even though there's oftentimes other people are the ones that assist in the suicide. I put the Dutch euthanasia law that likewise got passed in 2002. But the Dutch, interesting people, they practiced euthanasia for probably 20 or 30 years, but there's nothing legal about it. Technically, it was a criminal act, but they looked the other way. And it was something that was practiced for a long time. In fact, back in the 80s, the Royal Medical Society of the Netherlands put together a commission to look at this, to write up some guidelines to help the judicial system when some of these cases went to court as murder cases, and gave them some guidelines which the judicial system followed, even though there was no law about it. Then in the 90s, the government got involved. They formed a commission, and they used some of the criteria that had been recommended by the medical society, and then they developed a law, and that law got passed in 2002. All right. That's the history. Arguments used to support euthanasia. Well, there are common arguments that we're all aware of. One is a painful death. And this might have had a lot of application years ago, but today I don't think it's as important as it used to be. 90% of patients with pain can have their pain controlled with good pain control with narcotics. I don't think that doctors were as sensitive to this as they are now. There are now pain clinics, doctors that deal exclusively with pain. So only about 10% of people have what we would call excruciating, unrelenting pain. And in those cases, palliative analgesia is then employed. Palliative means that you give such a high dose of narcotics that you put the person in the semi-comatose or comatose states that they're unaware of their pain. The danger of that is that you can give too much and actually kill the patient. But then it's considered accidental, not euthanasia, because it was not intended. It was not an intentional act. It was an accident. So painful death is one argument used to support euthanasia. Undignified death. Again, if you think about it, I think death is probably undignified to anybody that dies. Our dignity is really the way we lived, the life we lived. But this is a reason that some people give, an undignified death. I think the one that holds the most water is loss of autonomy. And this would be the person that has lost control over their life and the timing and manner in which they die. So I think there's probably a fairly valid argument with loss of autonomy. And the burden on others, they don't want to be a burden on their family who's now the caregiver. Like this lady I talked about earlier, they don't want to exhaust financial resources that the family might have taking care of them. Burden on others is another reason given. The botched euthanasia, I think, is very flimsy. This is the patient that tries to commit suicide but is unsuccessful. And so then somebody needs to help them commit suicide. I don't like that argument, but that's used. All right. So what are some of the societal arguments against euthanasia? And I underline ethical here because to me, ethical is broader than Christian ethics. Ethical is our culture. What does our culture say against euthanasia? And then we'll get into Christian principles. Culture says that euthanasia affects other people. Well, death affects other people. Family, people, friends, colleagues at work. But it also affects the doctor if the doctor is involved in the process of euthanasia. Another argument is that does voluntary euthanasia lead to involuntary euthanasia? Is there a slippery slope we're about to enter? The slippery slope argument is used for a lot of issues. Slippery slopes says that, you know, here's this principle, and you change it just a little bit. A little bit later, you change it a little bit more. A little bit later, you change it a little bit more. So finally, you have a cumulative effect of all of these laws that have been passed that if they'd been put into a law to begin with, it would have never passed. But it's sort of like the frog in the hot water. You know, it's something that you begin to get a little bit more tolerant as time goes on. And so is there a slippery slope? And I think the experience in Nazi Germany would be a good example of that. There's some data that I got off the internet of some reports that would say that the slippery slope does occur. If you looked at the data from the Netherlands, this is in the 90s before the law got passed, 9% of annual deaths in the Netherlands was euthanasia. 9%. And then if you look at the data, let me see what year that was. The data in 98, just a few years later, the incidence was 15%. And there's several studies from the data in the Netherlands that show that even though you're supposed to report it, it's required by law, only about half of the cases of euthanasia get reported. Only about half. And then if you look at the data from 2013 in the province of Holland. Holland is kind of like a province or a county in the Netherlands. There were 130,000 people who died there each year. 20,000 of them were euthanized, which was 15%. And about half of those were involuntary. So what started out as voluntary back in the 70s and 80s, now 50% of patients are involuntarily being euthanized. In fact, I read an interesting article just a couple of days ago. There's a society in the Netherlands, I forget the name of it, where people can call in to find out which hospitals have the highest euthanasia rate so that they can avoid that hospital. Interesting, isn't it? There was another study I saw from the Netherlands which said they did a survey. They went out and people over 65 living in the community, healthy life, style, whatnot, they asked them whether or not they supported euthanasia. 50% said they did. If you went to nursing homes and asked people in nursing homes over 65 who were sort of confined to a nursing home, not able to have a very productive life, their support for euthanasia, 3% said that. Interesting, isn't it? So, slippery slope is, I think, a pretty valid argument. Euthanasia, does that pressure the patient to be euthanized? In other words, they're a burden on their family, or maybe they're a burden on their resources, but are they being pushed in that direction by family? I think this is going to be a big issue probably 20, 30 years from now as we talk about health care and the federal government. A big chunk of medical expenses come at the end of life. You spend a lot. We spend a lot of money at the end of life. You know, the last 6 months of life is a tremendous chunk of money is spent. And is there going to be a push by the federal government toward euthanasia to try and save these resources? I mean, this is a concern, I think, that it's not going to be obvious right now, but I think in 20 or 30 years it's going to be an issue. And then finally, euthanasia really is contrary to what the purpose of doctors are. Doctors are supposed to support life. We're supposed to try and improve health. And doctors as a whole don't want to be involved in euthanasia. Now, you'll find exceptions to that, obviously.
Charles.
But, yes. Question. Comment. Yes.
That goes on really right here, right now. A friend, a very dear friend of ours, 85 years old, went to a doctor. He had severe heart problems.
Right.
And the doctor said, "We're very sorry, there's nothing we can do for you." He went to another doctor who gave him two stents. And that's almost 2 years ago, and he's had a full life for those 2 years.
Right. this is a Hippocratic Oath. It's not used much anymore in medical schools. Very few medical schools use this. But because it was written in antiquity, it refers to gods of antiquity. But it did say, "I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, and not even suggest or give counsel to that." Christian Medical Society has written a Christian physician's oath, and I'm proud to say that the local chapter at Duke and UNC had some input into this. In fact, we use it every year when we have a graduation ceremony for the senior students that are becoming doctors, as we recognize their accomplishments and invite the families and everything. And so this is the same thing. And we are very much against euthanasia. So this is the Christian physician's oath. All right. Well, we've talked about the societal, our cultural arguments against euthanasia. Now let's look at the spiritual arguments, the biblical arguments. First of all, we're made in the image of God. Comes out of Genesis 1. God created us in His image. Man is forbidden to murder. The sixth commandment out of Exodus, "You shall not murder." And then also in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians, man is forbidden to murder. Another Christian argument would be that God is sovereign over death. He's the one that decides when we live and when we die. Deuteronomy, you can read that. And then likewise in Psalms 139, this scripture is often used an argument against abortion, but it's also an argument against us intervening in death. God is sovereign over death. Death is unnatural and inevitable. It's unnatural because we were not created to die. But because of our sin, we now experience death, and it is inevitable. We all die. There's not anyone in this room that's not going to die at some point in time. So, spiritually, we know that death is unnatural and inevitable. And death is a spiritual event with biological consequences. And we know that the body and the spirit are basically separate. And when the body dies, the spirit goes to be with God or to eternal damnation. Suffering may have value. May have value in our relationship to God. because now we understand the suffering of Christ better when we suffer. And it helps us in our relationship to our fellow man. When we suffer and are comforted by the Holy Spirit, it allows us then to comfort other people with the same kind of problem. And finally, death is not the end for a Christian. There's hope beyond death. We look upon death as a door, not as a brick wall. That's John, Philippians, and then a non-scriptural from Jim Elliot. This is not euthanasia. It's not euthanasia if you do not start treatment that would not provide a benefit to the patient. It's not euthanasia if you take away treatment that has been shown to be ineffective or doesn't help the patient or is not wanted. And giving high dosages of analgesics, morphine, etc., to try and put the person into palliative pain control, a semi-comatose state. If you overdo it and accidentally kill the patient, that's not considered euthanasia. So, what are the conclusions? Here are my conclusions. Natural death through progress of a terminal disease is not murder. Assisted suicide is murder. Why? Because it hastens death through conditions unrelated to the disorder. You intervene and interrupt that process by doing something that hastens death. What are our responsibilities to the person who is terminally ill? This applies to all of us, but as a doctor, I will not allow you to die in pain. I will not allow you to die alone. And you will not be a burden. So, what does the medical profession as a whole think about euthanasia? There are exceptions. We can live without it. Okay. Time for questions or comments. Sure, I'll raise some.
Charles.
Yes.
Go ahead. I have a case.
Yes.
Let's assume a neurosurgical department.
Okay.
A patient is delivered with a mental problem.
Okay.
Let's say a tumor or something like that. The neurosurgeon does his best, but turns the patient into a vegetable state. Then they leave the window open for fresh air therapy. Then bacteria come in, pneumonia sets in, the patient dies. I think this kind of a thing may go on.
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, there's bacteria within the hospital. In fact, you don't want to be in the hospital and be sick because of all the MRSA and all the organisms that tend to grow there. So, you know, it's entirely likely that he opened the window to allow this person to get fresh air. Fresh air is healthy for you. So I wouldn't consider that euthanasia at all.
Okay.
Most people with brain damage and in vegetative states, they don't breathe very deeply.
I see.
And they don't take a deep breath. If you think about it, when you breathe, every minute you breathe, you take a deep breath at some point in time. Because you don't fill up your lungs with air the way you should with a normal breath, but you sigh every so often. You don't realize it. It's an unconscious thing. And the purpose of that is to fill up all those little sacks in your lung, keep the stuff from accumulating there. Well, a person that's in a comatose or vegetative state doesn't do that. And so pneumonia is a natural cause of death in many of those patients. In fact, before the age of antibiotics, it was called the friend of the old person. That's what most people died of, was pneumonia. Now we die of cancer or heart attacks or something like that because we've got antibiotics to treat it. And the question comes up whether to put the person now that he's developed a pneumonia, whether you should treat him with antibiotics. See, that's the crux of the problem. Any other comments?
Charles.
Yes. Yes, Kathy.
Medicine and all of its goodness, I think because of all the wonderful interventions that it provides, it can actually be the catalyst for these ethical dilemmas that families have to go through.
This is hard. Even if you have a living will, a family member can go against that living will, causing a future dilemma for other family members. And that's what happened with us. Dad had a stroke. He couldn't eat. He was initially comatose. And the doctor came in and said, you know, we can keep him on IVs for a little while, but if he doesn't wake up to be able to eat himself, he will die unless you do insert a feeding tube. Daddy had a living will. Mama had just battled cancer, but she was alive, and she was his next of kin to make the initial decision. She said, put the feeding tube in. I don't want my husband to die. Then a year later, Mama died, and that left the three of us adult kids with the decision, you know,
right.
What do we do? We had to be logical. We had to, you know, you talk about alleged desires of the patient who was incapable of making a decision. We had to go back to the beginning and see that Daddy had a living will. And we saw that none of us lived in town. He had gained about 20 pounds or so because of the feeding tube, because he was paralyzed. He lost a lot of most of his brain function, and he hadn't been able to talk for a year. He didn't recognize most people who came in his room. And I was the one who had some paper.
Yeah. Living.
It was really, really hard. And so I think you're looking at all the definitions and all, but this is not euthanasia.
This is, and
why not? It's not easy. Even when you look at it, you go, you know he's going to be in heaven with Mom. You know he has no life. If he's living the way he is, we know he signed this saying it's not what he wanted. Emotionally, you know, it still leaves some scars.
Yeah. Well, there's no clear cut black and white. That's what I'm trying to say. It's important that everybody have discussions with their family. Everybody ought to have a living will and a health care power of attorney. If you don't, you need to do it. And in fact, if you talk to EMS people, they'll tell you if you've got a DNR, you put it on your refrigerator. Because if you have a DNR, do not resuscitate. If you have a cardiac arrest at home and the EMS shows up, they're going to resuscitate you. But that's the first place they look, is pull it on the refrigerator. And if you've got a DNR, you put it on your refrigerator. If you don't, that's right.
So how can you challenge a living will? I didn't realize that a family member. Well, even if it's
you know that now you really can't. You can carry it to court, but I mean it's very traumatic for everybody involved.
Well, how did your mom manage to override that?
Oh, Mama could get whatever she wanted.
Well, I can tell you manipulative.
No, I mean, she just said, you know, I am his number one power of attorney. It was Mama, then it was my sister, then it was me, then it was my brother, and we just went down the chain.
And that was the health care power of attorney?
Health care power of attorney.
See, that's different from a regular legal power of attorney. A health care power of attorney decides the issues to your health, your treatment, and actually to the manner in which your body is handled after death. Are you going to be cremated or buried or what? So the health care power of attorney deals with issues like that. And that's the reason why it's separate, because you don't want the person handling your estate and your money making those decisions.
So, when you have the healthcare proxy, then the living will tells the healthcare proxy what your wishes are, correct?
That's correct.
So in this case, your mom didn't follow
wishes. She didn't. And that was the only thing that we could fall back on, because it was an extremely difficult thing for us to do.
That's right. So you placed the family in a terrible position.
I think that's the importance too, Charles, that you said, is don't just have the healthcare, the living will, and the power of attorney. You have to talk about it.
Right.
Each other in the eye and say, this is really what I want.
I mean, you don't know how many times I would be taking care of a patient, and you know, a son from California that he hadn't seen his mom in 10 years would come back and demand this, this, and this, and this. I mean, just even in the care of a patient, it's not terminal. It becomes a terrible, puts the doctor in a terrible position trying to handle all that, because now you're trying to resolve family issues.
You mentioned the EMS. My wife's grandmother passed away this Friday. But the EMS, she was living in a retirement home, not a assisted living facility or anything else. She's 108 years old.
Oh, wow.
The EMS came in and put a breathing tube on. And we said, what? But because it's a retirement home,
that's right.
It's not a medical facility. They don't have DNRs. She's 108.
Yep.
So she had to, now she blissfully, went to the Lord 48 hours later. Once they took the breathing power, and she died.
But you can have a DNR even if you're not in a healthcare facility.
You can, but obviously.
You can, but see, the healthcare facility doesn't want to get sued.
Put it on the refrigerator. I had to.
The healthcare facility doesn't want to get sued. So they want to do everything.
Well, and the EMS guys,
to avoid that.
That's what they're doing.
If you call them, they have to do everything. And my
mother-in-law. Well, they're not legally. They're protected if you've got a DNR in their hand.
Charles.
And that's the reason why you put it on a refrigerator.
Charles.
Yes.
Well, first, you've been trying to speak.
Yeah, I've got.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I've got a story with a happy ending.
Good.
Many years ago, my brother was in a motorcycle accident, and he was paralyzed from the chest down. And a family member said he would be much better off if he had died. It's too bad he lived. And he went on to have almost 30 years of a very productive life. And interestingly enough, that family member later committed suicide.
Yeah. I have a different
perspective
slightly. And I've been through two things where no one in our family was in the medical field. And the physicians who were caring for my parents would not just flat out tell us what was happening and what was going on.
Right.
And so we couldn't truly make informed decisions about how to help care for my parents. And so, you know, from a non-medical perspective, how do you get the information? You don't even know what they're telling you. And I had one doctor tell me, actually, well, I know what you want me to tell you. You want me to tell you. And I'm like, you do not know what I want you to tell me. I want you to tell me in words that I can understand.
Tell them to speak English. Tell them to speak English.
So how do we address that kind of thing where doctors think they're saying, I mean, they're telling you what they know, but they have a different level of knowledge. And so the people who need information, you don't even know where to go look for it.
I mean, I can go to as many websites and read as much stuff, but that does not tell me, you know, what really is happening.
Bill Parsons back there is a doctor, and he's going to answer your question.
Well, Charles, you did a great job. I mean, this is a, I mean, for those of us who deal with patients who are dying, I probably have a half dozen patients that will die this year in a practice of about 2,000. And I can just say this is part of being a doctor. One of the things that the, and Charles and I are both members of the Triangle Christian Medical Association, Medical Dental Association. One of the things that that John Patrick emphasized years ago, he speaks for CBA frequently, he's an ethicist and a physician from Canada, is to identify physicians who sign and agree to the Hippocratic Oath. So the first thing I wear on my white coat is a pin which has the Caduceus and the Hippocratic Oath sign. And I think a fair question for any patient or family of patients is, are you a Hippocratic Oath physician? Even if you're not a Christian physician, are you a Hippocratic Oath physician? That is, will you take a life? And if the answer is, I am. Now, when I was in medical school back in the 70s, 78 to 80, we had to recite the oath. It was part of graduating from Dartmouth. But that is not the case anymore. They no longer require the recitation of the oath, as you pointed out. In very few medical schools require it. So the first is to start the process of communication, which, to your point, is the problem. The physician has to be aligned with the interests of the patient, and generally that is the case. The overwhelming majority of physicians actually get along with their patients. And the same patients get along with their physicians. Well, they would fire the doctor. So those of us who work together with each other and walk with each other, it comes back to the point that you made, which is we will never leave him. I think one of the promises of the doctor is you're going to go through this process of life and then death, and I will never leave. So I think that's the important difference. So the idea of abandonment has to be abandoned. The second point, so the first is the oath. The second is the idea that we are finite beings. Our cells are not programmed to go 200 years. The heart just goes about 100. And then it stops. And there's actually a programmed cell death called apoptosis. Some in the room are familiar with this. These cells don't just go infinitely. They actually stop dividing. They actually stop working. So programmed cell death. We are programmed, if you will, to die. So there is a finite length to living here. We have the hope of eternal life. The other thing I would point out is there is the importance of the living will, because the wishes of the family, and that was again stated, I can't overstate how important it is. What are your wishes? What are your interests? How can we work together? If we can focus on the interests of the patient, place the interests of the patient number one, it all works out. It all works out in the long run.
Okay. I think one of the challenges that medicine has today is our movement away from the family physician. If you don't have as much personal relationship with a doctor today, you know, you come into the hospital, you've got a problem, and you know they refer you to a specialist that deals with that problem. And then if you end up in the ICU, there's another team that takes care of you in the ICU. They don't even know the family. They don't know anything about you, but they're taking care of you for that finite period of time until you get better, hopefully, and then you go back to the floor, you might get another doctor. So the idea of finding a doctor that will be your doctor for life is of critical importance. I tell my physician, I say, Andy, please don't retire before I die. Because I don't want to have to find another doctor. Really don't. He knows my feelings. Okay, another question.
Yeah, Charles. Dr. Parsons, thank you so much. And Charles, this is really great. It's really important. But I think, and I don't know your name, so I apologize, but I think that the responsibility for the doctor today, it really is, and I think it's related to this family position, of finding, because we, as patients, we end up, or family members of patients, there's a team of this medical knowledge that we, the normal, non-medical people, don't understand that. And to find that one, and there are some doctors, there's a hesitation of telling the facts. The person is brain dead. Your loved one will not be the same person anymore. And, you know, I suspect many of us have been through that. But to find that one physician in that team of medical knowledge that end up taking care of us, that's a huge responsibility for this physicians today, or for that whole caregiving world of finding a person in plain language, like I like to say, using big crayons, so that even I can understand it, that it is real plain and simple, instead of, I think some physicians kind of hide behind all of the, you know, the language that I don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, half Latin, half whatever else it is. That the normal human beings don't necessarily understand or appreciate, instead of just saying they're not going to be the same person. You know, it's not blood. And I appreciate that hesitancy. I really do. But I think it's a real challenge for the medical profession.
Right.
I think related to the family physician.
Right. Okay. Back to the case.
Oh, yeah.
I advised this person that my pros and cons. She decided to put in the feeding tube because she feels that her daughter will regain her taste and enjoy eating. I cautioned her, there's another decision you might have to make down the line, and that is that if her taste doesn't come back, now you got to make a decision whether to pull the tube or whether to feed her. And a lot of medical decisions require thinking way ahead at the, you know, if we go in this direction, what do we do? If we go in that direction, what do we do? And a lot of people cannot do that. They're thinking about the immediate problem and not the other problems that it might bring up in the future. So you need to try and think through all of these different algorithms of what might happen when you do that. Yes.
If we distinguish between two kinds of ethics, a collectivist ethics and an individual ethics, I think in the older days, these decisions were all in the realm of individual ethics,
right,
between the patient, the doctor, and the family, and it was sort of extra-legal. Laws didn't come into the picture.
Right.
Now we have collectivist ethics.
I agree.
The question is, how do we balance the right of the patient to live or whatever against the common good?
Yeah,
the
government has gotten involved.
That's right.
How many people before Quinlan and Cruzan came up were their tubes pulled because there was an understanding between the doctor who knew the patient and the family who had been, you know, taking care of the family for years and years? Or how many people were taken off? Probably thousands. But it came up in the legal system, and so now we got to have all these laws.
Now we have very expensive treatment. Who's going to pay for it?
Yeah.
And you don't know anymore whether a doctor you consult has in his head a collectivist ethics.
Right. Exactly right. You don't know whether you've got a Christian doctor or not.
Right.
It's important to have a Christian doctor if you can find one.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's...
Charles.
Okay, Tom. All right, come on.
Okay, it's time to quit, folks. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Great job.